Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
All right, today we are rejoined by the author, journalist, and researcher Douglas Valentine. He's best known for his amazing books, The Phoenix Program, as well as his books, The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack, and especially the most recent book, Pisces Moon. Now, we're picking up from the last recording session, but how are you doing today?
I'm okay. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. I mean, this is a dream come true for me, so I'm happy as a clam. Now, I think we had left sort of, we talked about a lot of the background we needed to understand this story. Is that correct?
Yes, I tried to put a lot of that background in that hour that I sort of ranted the last time, but it's a big subject, and I'm trying to approach it comprehensively because the Harrelson case and my role in it within the context of not just what it means to be an American, what it means to be an American in Texas and down in the South on the border on Texas, what's happened to change the collective consciousness of Americans over the last 30, 40 years, and how that affects the way Americans, now that we're all on social media, view their relationship to America and crime, and how they see themselves as individuals in this situation that we're in, where everybody wants to really think that they're somewhat in control of what's happening to them. And at the same time, they all know they haven't got a fucking clue about what's really going on. And their voices mean nothing. And if you happen to line up with a particular movement at a particular time that's in the ascendant, well, maybe then you feel you're knowledgeable and you have some power. But at the same time, that's not true. And to a large extent, Americans are living in a reality that I was trying to come up with a metaphor for over the weekend. And also I could think of is that scene in Harry Potter when he's going to go out in order to get on the train to go to Hogwarts, he's going to run into a wall. And then magically passes through the wall, and the next thing he knows, he's on this train to Hogwarts. Well, I got to tell you, all of us are on that train to Hogwarts. And we've run through a wall, and the wall has just completely distorted reality. And people are sort of vaguely aware of it, but once you're on that train to Hogwarts, that's all you know. And that's where we're at. And so what I want to try to do today, which is an ambitious thing to do, it's sort of like a lecture you would get in a PhD literature course on the book called Charlie and Woody Harrelson. The book Doug wrote about the investigation of Charlie and Woody Harrelson and drug trafficking in the United States, and what does this mean? And how do you interpret that book? And to tell you the truth, I'm kind of flailing about how to do it, but I'll give it a go. Let me just start out by saying in the summer of 1992, August of 1992, Danny Sheehan and his private investigator, Bill Taylor, asked me if I would work for them. They had been working for Woody Harrelson, I don't know, for a year or two. I have no idea. Because Woody had gotten in touch with his father after he had made some money working at Cheers and playing the role of Woody Boyd, who's this country hick that goes works at a bar in Boston. And everybody loves him because he's completely ingenuous, He's like a cow grazing in a field, and or a panda bear in a zoo, and you can just come up and he's all cuddly, and you can pet him, and he does stupid things, and everybody loves him. And he had gotten a lot of mileage out of that, made a lot of money, and he was ascending and becoming a famous star, and he had some money, and he wanted to know what had happened to his father, Charlie Harrelson, who'd been convicted of murdering a federal judge in San Antonio. The judge was called Maximum John Wood because he was always handing out giant sentences for drug traffickers.
To the best of your knowledge, like, when did Woody learn these like deeper things about his father? Was it through communication with his father?
Well, I mean, he first found out about his father as a little kid. His father, he was born in 63, and his father had left in like, I don't know, 64, 65, 68, when he was first tried for murder. He was, Woody, Charlie Harrelson was first tried for murder around 1968. And then 1973 was tried for murder again and convicted and sent away for 5 years, and he got out in 78. And through that period of time, Woody was just a little baby boy growing up in a Presbyterian family with his two brothers, and being taught that, to go to his mother was the fundamentalist Presbyterian. And Charlie, Woody was like being teased by other kids who had heard on the radio in the neighborhood that Charlie was a murderer, and the other kids would beat the shit out of him, and he had this real inferiority complex because his daddy was a murderer. All right, and so it got so bad for the kids in his family that his mother moved everybody back to Ohio, where she was from. They were living in Texas at the time, and put him in school. Kind of religious schools, and he ended up going to a college where he was in a fraternity. He was a frat boy, and he was in the same, I think, for the same fraternity as Mike Pence.
Oh,
And he
interesting.
became buddies with Mike Pence as a young kid. I mean, that was his mindset. I mean, we're talking about a kid whose father is a homicidal maniac and his mother's a religious fanatic, and the kid's bouncing between these two polar opposites, and he has no idea who he is or what he is. So he becomes dumb Woody Boyd on a TV show, and all of a sudden he makes a lot of money, and when and he's becoming a part of the enlightened liberal, ultra-liberal Hollywood elite. And now he's got a lot of money, and he wants to find out what's going on. So he hires Danny Sheehan, who I tried to explain to you in this the previous interview that we did. That was a foundation why he would go to Danny Sheehan, and so Sheehan and his private investigator Bill Taylor and Woody get together, and they all go and they see Charlie, and Charlie tells them that the CIA and the DEA set him up, and that he worked for the CIA, and he was like running guns into Cuba, or all sorts of fantasies, which dovetailed exactly with the reality that Sheehan and Taylor, this is their life. I mean, this is what they love, and they say, sure, we'll take this case on. And the first thing they do is they hire regular Taylor's the investigator, and he hires a regular PI who goes down there to San Antonio, and he's one of these guys who's either an ex-cop or he took the 5-year course, and he goes around and he measures the distance at the crime scene, and he gets police reports, and he sends all these reports back to Taylor and Sheehan for about a year or two. I don't know, but nothing happens, and so Woody's already spent a bundle on him. And he's demanding results. And so even though these guys don't like me, they need somebody who can go down there to Texas and file leads anywhere across the country to prove that there's a possibility that Charlie Harrelson had CIA and DEA connections. But more importantly, and the job they hire me to do is to get material evidence that will get Charlie a new trial. That's material evidence. This is not conspiracy theory to, corral all the rumors about the CIA and the DEA and send all that stuff back so that it feeds Woody and Charlie's fantasies, but to actually get material evidence that can get the guy a new trial. So they come to my house and we talk about all this. And, I'm dubious of them. As I told you in the previous interview, I was good friends with Bill McCoy, who'd been a warrant officer in the US Army CID, and at that time was working for the Promise software guy, Bill Hamilton. And he'd been involved with Casolaro. And anyway, he knew Taylor. Bill McCoy liked Danny Sheehan and hated Bill Taylor. And he told me Bill Taylor was the kind of guy that would tell you a lie instead of the truth, even though the truth would serve him better, just because he liked telling, just because he couldn't stop himself from running through the wall and getting on the Hogwarts train. I mean, he always wanted to be in this fantasy world. So to beware of him if I went to work for him, and I said, okay, I'll beware. And so the first thing that they do, Sheehan and Taylor, when they hire me, is they say, okay, Charlie says that he was in Dallas on the day of the assassination, May 29th, 1979, that he had spent the night with a CIA officer's wife, and then he'd taken a flight to Dallas with a stewardess who he betted, and he was actually in Dallas on the day of the assassination. And they say, if you take the job, we'll give you $25 an hour, including for some of your prep work. And we'll pay for your travel time and your lodgings and your all your expenses. And you can follow any lead you want anywhere around the country. We're not going to tell you what to do, but we couldn't get anywhere. And you're the only one that knows CIA officers and can actually get them to talk to you and high-ranking public officials. And so we'll give you the job if you do this. And so we're sitting there, and I say, okay, well, first thing I got to do is talk to Charlie.
Natural starting place.
I mean, where do you start? Well, I said, well, I got to go talk to the guy and find out who the CIA guy is, and all the CIA connections. And they tell me, no, that's the one condition of the case. You can't talk to Charlie and you can't talk to Woody.
Doesn't sound right.
And everything I'm going to send to Woody is going to be filtered through them. Okay, so, being the idiot that I am, I think, oh, okay, this isn't some sort of setup. And the other thing is that I can't tell anybody that I'm working for them. My cover on this investigation is that I'm going to be writing a book about the DEA and the CIA's infiltration of the DEA, which is exactly what I was doing anyway.
Real cover, yeah.
So any cover is exactly what you were going to do anyway. I mean, if they send a CIA undercover to the Philippines and he runs a Ford franchise, he actually runs the Freud franchise. He does the Ford franchise visit. If they send a CIA officer undercover to as official capacity as in the visa section of the Warsaw Embassy, he actually makes up visas, and then
Yeah.
2 hours a day meets his agents and stuff. So the best cover is actually something you're really doing. So I say, okay, this is like another deal with the devil. I'm going to get to write my book. I'm going to play along with their game. I'm going to compromise my integrity by faking out all these guys who've been in the spy business all their lives. I'm not allowed to say I'm actually a private investigator, but every single person I ever talked to me looked at me like, who are you, what are you, who are you really working for? I mean, it's like,
That's
anyway,
funny.
so we're going to maintain like three or four fictions while this whole thing is happening because we're all part of, we're all on the train to Hogwarts, all right? And this is the reality that I'm going to be working in. And I agree. And because I'm going to be able to go all over the country and research my book for free, and get paid to do it. And it's this huge boon for me. And they also tell me that if I do a good job, Woody is going to allow me to help write the movie script for, and I'm going to be part of the movie that they're going to make out of this. And I'm thinking what Bill McCoy said to me. They'll tell you a lie when the truth would work just as well. It didn't really matter to me. I didn't expect that to happen. I'd already signed one or two movie deals. And you actually have to talk to the person that you're making the deal with. I mean, it wouldn't happen unless I talked to Woody and Woody said, this is the deal we're going to make, and here's where you sign, and all that sort of stuff. And they're making this promise to me, which they did not have to make. So there's this air of unreality in dealing with Taylor and Shea and with Woody Harrelson and Charlie Harrelson, which, frankly, again, metaphorically, is the situation that anybody who's actually after the truth in America, or not the truth, not, but material evidence, and there is no truth, all right, but the material evidence, who's actually trying to do an investigation to find out historically what happened so they can understand what's happening now, better understand what's happening now, and see the arc of factual progressions. Dealing within this, these multiple levels of fantasy is what we're all dealing with, except a lot of people unconsciously accept this fantasy world and really believe that they're going to Hogwarts and that they're going to solve the Kennedy assassination or the Casolaro assassination, or that they actually think Davy Talbot in his book, The Devil's Chessboard, actually solved the Kennedy event. I mean, they live in the, or they think, and this is the biggest fantasy of all, is that Donald Trump is fighting the deep state, and there's 50 million people that actually believe, I mean, they really believe this, that Donald Trump is fighting the deep state. And I have people say to me all the time, oh, you don't like Donald Trump, you must be part of the deep state. So dealing with it in this within the fantasy world, and at the same time trying to find material evidence about what's actually happening, has been what's going on in my career for over 40 years. So, which and with Sheehan and Taylor, I mean, I'm already accustomed to it. At that point, I've already been investigating the CIA for 8 years. So I'm accustomed to working in a world of illusions and, the hall of mirrors and all that stuff. So fine. But it's going to advance my own personal interests. And so I start. And first person I interviewed in, I guess it was September of 92, was Carl Schauffele, who was the guy who busted the Watergate burglars. And Schauffele was a friend of Dan Moldaves, who's a very good writer and does a lot on organized crime. And I'm going to be getting into organized crime very deeply. So I talked to Schauffele, and Schauffele said, well, yeah, you're going to find out that the CIA and the DEA are involved in all this, but you're never going to be able to prove anything, just like we couldn't prove anything in Watergate. But yeah, and he sent me to a guy named Alan Block. Alan
Interesting.
Block is it was a criminologist, then working at State College in Pennsylvania. one of the most intelligent and knowledgeable people I've ever met in my life.
His
And
books are incredible, yeah.
I mean, Alan Block, if you don't know him out there and you want to know some things about what's going on, just look him up and read his books, okay? Masters of Paradise is a good one to start with.
Oh, yeah.
It's up there with Peter Dale's Scott's The War Conspiracy. You know, I mean, it's a good factual book to start with. And plus which Alan Block was a wonderful man. And he helped me out. Alan Block helped me out more with my own book than he did with the Harrelson investigation. Okay. And this was something that happened basically 90%, 95% of the time, is everywhere I was going, people were helping me out with my book. And maybe there'd be one little tip that they'd give me about the case, which was fine with me because I knew the case was all bullshit anyway. So Block was a wonderful guy. And what he had done, him and his partner at the time, a guy named Mick Williams, who was also teaching at State College, they were the people who first investigated George White in any serious way. George White, the FBI ultra guy. And they were writing articles about it in the early 80s. And I hadn't heard of George White and Garland Williams until I met Alan Block. And this is 1992, and I'm just starting my book. And he knew a lot about it. Alan Block had gone to the library out in California where George White's diaries and correspondence are being held. All right. And everybody in the world who wants to know about MK Ultra wants to know about George White. And Alan Block went out there before anybody. And it's a private collection. You can't bring any pens or pads and copy anything down. You can't bring a camera in if you go in to view the George White material. But Alan Block is a professor at this college, and he's a published author, and he's a serious writer. So they let him into this room all by himself, where he sits for 8 hours with a tape recorder in the pocket of his suit jacket and a microphone hidden underneath his shirt. And he reads every part, he reads the entirety of George White's diary into his
What?
microphone, into his tape recorder. And he reads all the correspondence over, this is over a day or two or three, into his tape recorder. And the librarians all say, "Oh, you're such a gentleman. It's great to have you here, you know." And he says, "Yes, I learned a lot reading this stuff, you know." And then he goes home, and the woman he was working with made transcripts of all these tapes that he had made. So he had stolen Alan's, has passed into the real Hogwarts.
I had no idea that Block was into that stuff.
And it doesn't matter telling the story anymore, but he's passed away. And he says, "What?" He's telling me this story. I'm like cracking up. We're having a couple of beers in the lobby of this hotel where he's staying in. And again, this is the kind of thing that you got to do if you're going to be investigating. You know, you got to lie, steal, and cheat. You know, I mean, this is the way it works. And if you're this eminence like Alan, and he says, "I'll send it all to you." And he sent me copies of all these documents,
Jeez.
which I sent to the National Security Archives. I don't know where Alan Block's archives are, but anyway, that's an example I'm giving you of the kind of information that I was getting that helped my books. And he gives me the name of a informant, a guy named Billy Breen, who worked on the Shagra case. All right, now Shagra was the guy who allegedly hired Charlie Harrelson to kill this judge. And the Chagras had this big drug network. They lived in El Paso. If you live in Texas, you know where it is. If otherwise, West Texas kind of goes up under New Mexico, and that's new. And El Paso is at the very far end of West Texas, under New Mexico, right on the Mexican border. And it's, on the border. And the Chaga family has been dealing drugs, mostly marijuana, out of Mexico for 1,000 years. They're like a Syrian or Lebanese, I can't, family that came and settled there. And they have Syrian or Lebanese relatives in Mexico. And they have this pipeline of drugs coming into through El Paso. And they're sending them around the country. They're sending them to contacts in Florida. They're sending them to contacts in Tennessee, Kentucky, and they're sending them to contacts up in Boston. And Billy Breen, and then they go with the money they make, the Chagras. It starts out as three brothers, Lee, Jamie, and Joey. And they're lawyers, except for Jimmy, who's just a trafficker. And then they go up to Las Vegas, where they gamble their money that they make drug dealing, and it's a way of laundering their money. And all the mafia casino owners up there, who all linked to Don Trump, the guy who's fighting the deep state. All these mob families up there, at the time Trump's trying to get casinos in Atlantic City so he can Russia launder all his Russian mob money. The guys up there, the mafia guys up there, are all working with the Chagras. And this is the actual mafia, all right? And it's largely the patriarchal family, which is established in Boston and through New England. And this informant that Alan Block refers me to, Billy Breen, had infiltrated the mafia in all these places. And he had put a lot of people in prison. And he was, but being a, he's a professional informant, which is a strange class of person. You should get to know them if you really think you know something about how America works.
I was going to ask you if you had ever read very much Thomas Pynchon, because I know that is one of his many interests and concerns in his fiction.
Well, sure. I the best book I liked for his was Crying a Lot, 22. I think Gravity's Rainbow didn't do much for me. That bored me. But I understand what he's trying to do. And I know he was kind of considered all the thing for a while, but he also, in his way, was trying to do what I'm trying to do here, and which all writers are trying to do, which is try to understand what it means to be an American. And so what it means to what the American consciousness is. And he was trying to do it in a way that involved all the technology and the sexual hang-ups. And he did a lot of it by connecting all these sexual fantasies and hang-ups that Americans have to atomic weapons and the power of our military. And it's all a very legitimate way of looking at it. And he, had an interesting prose style, but like any American writer, this is what he's trying to do, and he did it in his way. I'm trying to do it in a non-fiction way, and at the same time, point out to people what actually happened. He was trying to do it in a through fiction. Okay, same thing. Trying to do the same thing, and organized crime. Crime is a big part of what it means to be an American, but a lot of Americans have no idea of what it really means or how it goes on. They don't know that the cop in town's on the take, and that he's protecting the mafia. They go to school with his kids and they think he's a good guy. They don't know that he's a racist, and he's making cases against all the blacks and minorities and politically corrupt, cases that he should make. But by the time I'm on this case, I understand all that. I have connect, I've written a book about the CIA, and everywhere I go, despite having written a book about the CIA, everybody wants to talk to me and tell me what fuckers the CIA are, because CIA is fucking everybody all over the place all the time. And nobody has more deeper relationships with organized crime in the United States than the CIA. Okay, the CIA has been using organized crime for multiple purposes for a long, long time. And they are out of reach of the FBI. But in around 1968, they start infiltrating the DEA. All right. They have always had a symbiotic relationship with, first with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is in existence from 1930 and existed long before the CIA. But by the time the CIA is up and running in 1947 or 48, they've already formed relationships with the Bureau of Narcotics, and they're actually using the Bureau of Narcotics for cover for its operations around the world. They're using major drug traffickers to try to assassinate Fidel Castro. They're using them to transport drugs for their clients in Laos. They're, and all around the world, and their operations all around the world. And all most of the DEA, all the narcotic agents that go overseas are working for the CIA under Narcotic Bureau cover. They certainly are spending half their time doing CIA jobs. This is all in the book Strength of the Wealth. Okay. And so I understand that. And I also understand that in 1968, during the Vietnam War, all of a sudden their narcotic operations are coming under scrutiny in the press. Al McCoy goes over in 71 and exposes a lot of it. And the only way that they can prevent the genie from getting out of the lamp is to actually infiltrate it and take over the DEA. Okay, so anyway, I'm following up Breen's, based on all the information I know about Breen and the infiltration on behalf of the FBI into the organized crime organization that the Chaga brothers are part of, which is throughout Texas, Florida, Tennessee. They're sending shipments of marijuana up to Boston. It's all done in cahoots with the actual mafia, which owns the casinos where they're gambling and laundering their money. Okay. So, and Breen, through Breen, I meet dozens of contacts who are telling me about how they organize this organized crime aspect of the Chagra drug organization works. And at the same time, I go and I talk to early on a guy named Bud Mullet. Now, I'm supposed to find material evidence about how what really what to get Charlie out of jail. And Bud Mullen was the head of investigations for the FBI. He was a career FBI agent. And he was in charge of FBI all investigations around the country. And when Wood is murdered, the first person, he's murdered in San Antonio, and there's an FBI agent there named Morrow. And Morrow thinks it was the Bandidos motorcycle gang that did it, and he focuses exclusively on the Bandidos. The U.S. attorney in San Antonio, a guy named Jamie Boyd, thinks it's Charlie Harrelson. So there's this huge conflict between the US attorney, Jamie Boyd, and the FBI that's going on in the early days of the Harrelson, the Wood investigation. And the FBI agent thinks it's the Bandidos because in late 1978, they had tried to kill an assistant U.S. attorney. The man, they thought it was the Bandidos, had tried to kill a guy named James Kerr, who was the guy that the Jamie Boyd had working against and making a case against Jimmy Chagra. So there's a lot of history there going on, and Mullen tells me the whole history. I mean, guys like Mullen talk to me, which is why they hired me.
Right.
Okay. And Mullen assigns in 1980 a guy named Jack Lawn to replace Morrow. And Jack Lawn is the next guy that I arranged. Oh, and I should tell you that in 1981, when the Reagan administration takes over, Edwin Meese, who's the attorney general on behalf of Reagan, appoints Bud Mullen head of the DEA. So I'm getting tons of information from my book, but Mullen also was the one who makes the Wood case, brings it together when he's with the FBI, starts focusing the investigation through Jack Lawn, who he assigns as the FBI agent in charge of San Antonio, replacing the jerk who thought it was the Banditos that killed him. And then Mullen becomes head of the DEA. And when he becomes head of the DEA, he makes Jack Lawn his assistant. And he says, and he also tells me, Mullen, that I got to talk to an FBI agent named Bob Wyatt, who actually makes the Judge Wood case and pins it on Charlie. So now I got a lead down in Texas. And he says, you should also talk to Jamie Boyd. So now we're getting into the spring. There's a million other things going on. Mm-hmm. And in the spring, I called this guy, Jamie Boyd, who was the U.S. attorney up until 1981 when Reagan replaced him. He was the first U.S. attorney that Reagan and Meese kicked out. They wiped out all the Democrats and replaced them all with Republicans, which is pretty much par for the course.
Right.
And because you want a political control of all criminal investigations, because all criminal investigations reach back locally to politicians and businessmen, all of whom, I'm trying to tell you, are integrally involved with organized crime, which is how they get their positions and their jobs. You're just not supposed to know about it. And that's the real Hogwarts reality that's going on, okay, is that politicians and law enforcement are involved with organized crime in a way that you don't understand, and that the job of organized law enforcement is basically prevent you from understanding how the politicians and the businessmen are involved with organized crime. And by that, I mean people like Donald Trump, okay, especially. And the job of the intelligence agencies and law enforcement is to prevent you from nobody. So contrary to everything you think, Donald Trump is not fighting the deep state. The deep state's actually fucking protecting him, so you don't know how it works.
Well said. Okay. Well said.
Get on back to the case. You know, I go and I call up Jamie Boyd. And Boyd tells me that he would love to talk to me. That they got the right guy, but they didn't get everybody. And that, and Boyd has passed away, so I don't mind telling you all this either. But he's afraid to talk to me because he's afraid that it'll actually allow Charlie Harrelson to get out of prison. The material evidence. He's willing to give me the material evidence to get Charlie out of jail. But he's not sure he wants to talk to me, because he doesn't want to be getting dragged in front of a grand jury. He doesn't want to ruin people's careers. He doesn't feel like he doesn't really say he's an aggrieved person. And I said, well, you know, you can set whatever. It's like, and nobody's supposed to know that I'm working for Danny Shee. And here a guy is telling me the information that I could give you could get Charlie out of jail. You know what I mean?
Jeez.
All right, so I mean, understanding that at the same time this is going on, just as to put it into context, I have sued the CIA for my personal file. And I am, at the same time that I'm talking to Jamie Boyd, I sue the CIA in federal district court in Springfield, Massachusetts, where I live. This is April 1993 now. The CIA actually has to send an attorney up to the federal court in Springfield, Mass. And this man, the CIA attorney, is working with the US attorney in Springfield, a woman named Karen Goodwin. And I am represented by the ACLU before a judge named Podser. And I'm saying I want access to my CIA file. At the same, so the Department of Justice is working with the CIA in Springfield, and I'm trying to get my CIA file, which the judge gives me most of. And at the same time, I'm talking with Jamie Boyd, but Jack Law, and they all know, and they start following me around Texas because they want to know, well, what is this fucking guy up to now?
Oh, jeez.
All right, so the idea that nobody knows what I'm doing is ludicrous. And yet, within the Woody, Sheehan, Taylor universe, we're maintaining that fiction, okay? Because that's the only way we can really hustle Charlie and Woody. That, by the way, that who's being referred to at this point as the Golden Goose.
Oh, geez.
You know, the money is flowing in. I get my little bit, but most of it's going to Taylor and Sheehan. I mean, you know, I get a little piece of it, you know, but like any, the employers take 90% of what you get, you know, and they give, throw
Right.
you a little. But anyway, so Wood says to me, well, I'm kind of undecided. And I said, well, I'm seeing Jack Lawn tomorrow. He says, you seeing Jack? He said, well, that changes everything. If Jack Lawn tells you who he liked and, you know, helped start focusing the case on Charlie and who becomes when Bud Mullen, who runs FBI investigations, becomes head of the DEA in 1981, makes Jack Lawn his deputy. And when Bud Mullen retires, Jack Lawn becomes head of the DEA. And I'm talking to these guys, and they're telling me everything about the case. And Boyd says, well, if you talk to Jack Lawn, man, that changes everything. Write me a letter after you talk to him and tell me what he said. So, by the way, Mullen said to me that one of the things he did, and everything's in the book, Strength of the Pack. One of the things he did was put an end to the CIA practice of using the DEA as cover. That's 19 begins start beginning in 1981. The CIA, however, was never fully forthcoming and continued to do it because it felt its mission was more important than the DEA's. Mullen reminded me that the DEA did not know where to find Kiki Camarena's body until the CIA told them where to find it. So Mullen hates the CIA too, and he's glad to tell me all this stuff and refer me to people who are going to put me on the track of showing how the CIA corrupted the DEA. All right. And although they, like Carl Schoffler told me, yeah, you're going to find out it's true and it's all true, but you're never going to be able to actually prove it. And Lawn tells me how he actually, once he takes over the investigation for the FBI, the Harrelson Wood Harrelson investigation, he focuses it on Jimmy Chagra, then is in prison, being represented by his brother Joey, and when the way that they sort of crack the case and Lawn tells me this. I interviewed him at Yankee Stadium. He was in Chief of I interviewed Bud Mollen at his home in Connecticut, which was only an hour from where I live. And I interviewed Lon in New York City at Yankee Stadium, where he was chief of operations. And he had this big, I mean, I got to Yankee, I'd seen Mickey Mantle when I was a kid at Yankee Stadium, you know. And he's now chief of operations. And we're the only ones in this big, huge office that he has with this plate glass window overlooking Yankee Stadium. And like all these guys, he really likes me. I know everything. I don't have to explain anything to me. I'm very athletic looking, you know. I mean, I know all about the CIA and all this kind of stuff. And he really likes me and he tells me everything. And he even arranges for us to go walk out into the field on Yankee Stadium. And he shows me where all the statues are of Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle, all this stuff. And it's a rainy, cold day. I mean, neat experiences, just to tell you the things that can happen as an investigator. But he tells me how to crack the case. And it was the first time the FBI did it. They actually recorded the conversations, which are lawyer-client privacy between Joey and Jimmy when they're in the prison. And he said he created a white and a black team. And the white team went through and segregated out everything that they felt complied with warrant, lawyer-client privilege, but anything that had to do with the Wood assassination went to the black people, and they could use it in the prosecution against Jimmy and Joey Chagra. And in the course of doing this, they overhear Joey and Jimmy talking about how they arranged the assassination. Boom! It basically the case is cracked. All
Case
right, so
closed.
now I can go down and I can talk, and I tell this in my letter to Jamie Boyd, and he says, "Come on down, I got a lot of stuff to tell you." And so in July, I go down to, I actually meet him in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, which is where he lives, and he gives me a stack of documents this big about all his hassles with the Department of Justice and with the FBI, and how the FBI was initially subverting his case, not just against Charlie Harrelson, but against the drug cases against Jimmy Chagra and the organized crime network, and how the Department of Justice was involved with it, which is why Boyd is so uptight, because the guy that he was fighting at the time, in 1990, which is 1981, you know, 79, 80, 81, guy named Philip Heymann, is at this particular moment, 1993, the assistant attorney general, and has all power, all, you know, over everybody and everything that's going on. So Boyd's very uptight, but at the same time, he says, you know, I'm resentful. And if it gets Charlie out of jail. And he gives me all this stuff, and of course, and I send it to Taylor and Sheehan. So basically, at that point, they have everything they need to get Charlie a new trial. And this is in July. And but they don't want me to kill the golden goose by actually ending the investigation. All right, so keep going. What more can you find? And so in October, I mean, and a million other things are happening, guys. I mean, this is beyond encapsulating in an hour. I find out that Boyd had hired, because he was having so many problems, he created his own investigative team. And one of the main characters is a guy named Jack Compton, who is like incredibly invaluable to me, and had actually written a deposition for a US attorney that was in the Western District before Boyd about corruption in the DEA. This goes back to 1975. Anyway, there's a bunch of those other guys, and I gave all those documents to the National Security Archives too. All the stuff Boyd gives me about corruption within the DEA and its relationship to the CIA. And one of the guys that's on in 1980, Boyd creates his own special team. Jack Compton's on it. So is a guy named Chris Thompson. Chris Thompson was a CIA officer, one of the CIA officers that was infiltrated into the DEA and went into Lou Conein's DEA Special Operations Group. And it was assigned in 1975 to El Paso to run a covert intelligence operation into Mexico, working with the CIA officer who was in charge of the Mexican province across the border. And I sent you a document a little while ago of an interview that I did with Hugh Murray, who did the same thing for Conein and the DEA Special Operations Group out of Tucson, Arizona, where he set up a safe house. And what the DEA Special Operations Group doing was with CIA officers like Chris Thompson, which were spread out all along the Mexican border. Well, it's very lengthy. They were working with a DEA operation called TriZo, which was looking for, ostensibly looking for poppy opium fields. And they were working with a CIA Air Force from Evergreen, a CIA proprietary company, to like spray them. And that whole operation was cover for a CIA operation. And Chris Thompson was part of it, as was Hugh Murray. I gotta refer you guys to the book. Or if afterwards you could put up or read into this the transcript I sent you about Pemex and the petroleum export company of the Mexico and how it all had to do with controlling the political climate in Mexico. They were using infiltrating, they were using Mexican informants, which they weren't supposed to be doing, these DEA SOG guys. They were using drug traffickers like the Chagras, bad Americans who were walking the edge. That's what Hugh Murray told me, how they described them, which would be Charlie Harrelson and his Dixie Mafia guys. And they're using them to go to run drugs, but also agent nets inside Mexico. And they're still doing this today, folks. All right. They're doing this right now as we speak. They're using the DEA and the FBI and anybody else, the Immigration Service, the Border Patrol, to run agent nets inside Mexico to destabilize the northern provinces and so that they can keep the government, central government of Mexico weak. And at the time, in the late 1970s, the biggest drug trafficker in Mexico is the president of Mexico. And at the same time, Richard Secord and Tom Clines, through their Cuban assets, are working with Pemex, this organization that is also working with the CIA. And it's this tangled web that actually is the origins of the CIA DEA nexus that we're talking about that goes on in Texas. I haven't got time to explain it all to you. You got to read the book, all right? And that's where it's explained, the strength of the pack. But anyway, at this point, I start getting on to that. And I talk to Chris Thompson, and who's on Boyd's team. And I talk to, which tells you what, which tells you that the CIA knows everything that's going on every minute of this investigation. Because once you're in the CIA, you're always in the CIA, and they're still reporting back. And I talk to you, Murray, and getting all this stuff from my book. But I also now start getting into, and I talk to Bob Wyatt, the guy that Mullen told me to talk to. And I start getting involved with what's called the Dixie Mafia, which is the dangerous part of the job. This is Charlie Harrelson and his childhood friends from Texas, Pete Kay, Little Illy Culbreth, Culbreth. I sent you a picture of Culbreth with Robert Riojas, who offered information on the assassination in 1979. And the FBI wouldn't let him give it to Jamie Boyd. And it wasn't until, and Heyman wouldn't let, the big shot wouldn't let Boyd do a deal with Riojas down in El Paso because it would have involved, exposed all the CIA stuff, the gun running, the actual controlled deliveries of drugs from Mexico into the United States. Going to not just people like Shocker, but going to the Dixie Mafia guys like Harrelson and Pete Kay and all these guys who, and the Bandidos, and how the whole drug trafficking organization was set up there, and how a lot of it is controlled by the CIA because they want to use the assets at the other end to destabilize the government and report on what's going there. And they got to feed these guys some money, and the drug trade, the armed trains is a way to do it. Okay, so now I'm getting involved in this and I'm starting to get death threats down there. And in October, I actually go to Huntsville. Oh, I should mention I'd had another chat with Taylor and I'd said, oh, that deal with Woody, I'm ready to sign a contract with him. Because before I went in to start actually risking my life, I wanted to get things on the table with Taylor, who was sending my ass in to trip the wire. Okay. They want me to keep
Right.
going. I don't care whether I live or die. They just know that, like the CIA knows, like the Department of Justice knows, like the FBI knows, everybody knows everything I'm doing down there. It's only a secret to Woody, all right, because she and Taylor are, keeping everything up, but everybody else in the world knows everything I'm doing. And I get down to Huntsville, Texas, which is basically where Charlie grew up, Charlie Harris, and where the Dixie Mafia is headquartered. And I start interviewing people that were their attorneys. And criminal defense attorneys are a strange group of people. They actually form friendships with the criminals, all right? And they know a lot about them. And I'm meeting the criminal defense attorneys who represented Peter Kay, who was Charlie's childhood friend down there in Huntsville. Charlie Harrelson actually married Joanne, who'd been Pete Kay's wife before Charlie married.
Oof.
And Charlie was carrying on an affair with her daughter at the same time he was
Oh, geez.
carrying an affair with Joanne. And Joanne's the person who buys the murder weapon for Charlie in the Judge Wood case. And Liz Chagra, who was Jimmy Chagra's wife, was involved in that. And the three of them are the ones who go down for the Wood assassination. But I'm getting involved now with the Dixie Mafia, Peter Kay, an attorney named Alan Brown, who Jimmy Boyd told me was involved. I sent you a document about phone calls that Alan Brown had with Larry Culbreth. Now, I don't know whether it's true. And Alan Brown's still alive and practicing. And I just want to make sure that he understands that I'm telling you that this is just what Jamie Boyd told me and the case that he wanted to make. Nobody ever implicated in any legal way Alan Brown and any of this stuff, but I'm talking with all the attorneys for these guys, and I'm learning, for example, that Pete Kay at the end of his life, and he's already dead, had made a tape of actually how, honestly, and I learned this from one of his attorneys, the assassination went down. And he tells me where he thinks the tape is. And now, and I talked to Bob Wyatt, who's the guy who got, at the same time that Charlie's having an affair with Peace Dar's wife, who he marries, and her daughter, he's also having an affair with a guy named Hampton Robinson's wife while Hampton Robinson is j in jail. And Hampton Robinson tells the FBI agent, Bob Wyatt, and Bob Wyatt tells me this. Like 2 days after the assassination of Judge Wood, that Charlie Harrelson did it, and he knows who, how it happened. And I'm learning all that information, how all that went down. All this is happening in Huntsville. And it's all going to end up with me going to see the sheriff, a guy named Darryl White, who had been the sheriff in Walker County, which is where Huntsville is located, for 20 years, from like 68 to 88. And I'm at the New Zion Missionary Baptist Barbecue in Huntsville, which is an open tent barbecue like you only really find down there in Texas, where they it's an outdoor barbecue. I mean, it's gigantic, you know. There's this, and the guy is cooking up all these slabs of meat, and they're serving them inside the black guy, and it's got to be like working on a furnace in a coal mine, and you know, coal ship, or on the train. You know, I mean, it's so hot, and it's hot down there anyway, and everybody's eating on paper plates. In the you know, and drinking cups of beer, and having lunch there, and I call up this guy Darryl White, and he said, "Oh, Valentine, yeah, you were here yesterday, right?" I'm going, "I was there yesterday." So you're the writer from Massachusetts to want to interview me. You were here yesterday, right? I did the interview with you. I said, "Well, no, I'm here today to do the interview." So we go do the interview, and I ask him what the guy looked like who was posing, impersonating me.
Jeez.
And so I'm starting to get a little nervous, to put it mildly. So I write up my final reports, and Taylor has already told me that no, he lied to me. There was no, not going to be any movie deal. And it's gotten to the point where my life is being threatened. I've actually sent them long ago all the information that they need, the material evidence to show that the FBI has been fucking around with the trial, with the evidence, to get them the material evidence to get Charlie a new trial. And I quit. And it's run its course, and Taylor and Sheehan come to my house here in Longmeadow, and they're really upset, and they want to know why I'm killing the golden goose, why I'm quitting. I wouldn't tell them, and Sheehan gets really mad, and starts pounding the dining room table where we're talking, and I get up and I walk into the living room and sit down. I'm, you know, just not going to tell him. And Taylor comes in and he says, "Oh, it's because you had to trick all those people." And I just look at him. You know, I mean, he's still exempt. He's been living in his Hogwarts world where he makes up all these fantasies for so long that he thinks that everybody's living there. And then he says, "You're quitting because of me, right?" I just stare at him. You know, I mean, I didn't answer him or anything. And that's it. Boom, I'm off the case. And now they actually have all the information they need, really. But a couple of months later, I get a call from Woody, Actually, a young woman calls up my house and she says, "Is Doug Valentine there?" And I said, "Yes, I'm Doug Valentine. I'm here." She says, "Would you please wait a minute? Woody Harrelson would like to talk to you." That's the first time in my life that somebody's girl has called me up, saying that the master is over doing something. And at the time, she's on the set of Natural Born Killers,
Oh, interesting.
where he's channeling his father, Charlie.
Jeez.
And he's all hung up in the psychodrama of this whole case and his identity and who am I? Am I Woody Boyd or am I Mickey Knox, the killer, like my dad and Oliver North,
Stone.
is manipulating the shit out of him because Oliver
Oh, really?
does all the stuff and he's just like pushing all his buttons and Woody at
Jeez.
the time is like wound up tighter than a bull's ass in fly tie. And he gets on the phone and he says, "I understand you've got information that can get my father out of prison." And I said, "Well, everything I have I gave to your bosses, And he says, "You gotta tell me right now what it is you know. They tell me you know something that you never told them." And I said, "Woody, fuck off." And he went off the deep end. He goes, "You work for me. You gotta tell me everything you know." I worry, "Woody, I don't work for anybody." Plunk, and I hung up. So 10 minutes later, the phone rings, and it's Woody, it's not his girl. And he says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Valentine. I'm on the movie set, and my time is very precious to me." And I said, "Well, guess what, Woody?" He goes, "What?" I said, "My time's very precious to me, and I don't want to waste it talking to you." And I hung up again. Boom. Now I realize if I kissed his ass, I'd have gotten to say that Woody's my friend or something like that, but I had nothing to give him. I mean, I had really given him everything, and any more kind of an investigation really would involve me being killed. And I would really wasn't quite interested in dying at that point because I was just really beginning to get all this information on the interrelationship, through the Harrelson case, which is a example of the a domestic version example with Chagres and DEA and the CIA using the DEA as cover and all these political ops that are going on in Mexico and how it's all a bunch of bullshit and the whole schmear was all finally coming together to me. And I was still a young man. I didn't want to die. And so I and then like 3 years later, just to wrap it all up, Woody calls me up again. And Sheehan and Taylor have found a judge in Denver who's willing to hear the case. And they're going to present the case. They had to find a venue where I assume they're going to use my, all the information I gave them, which was material evidence. I mean, it was documents, okay? Actual documents. And that they could use to ask for a new trial for Charlie. And Woody calls me up and he says, "Oh, hey, Mr. Valentine, I'm down in Martha's Vineyard with Ted Danson, and we're smoking a little pot, and we're wondering if you'd like to come down and talk to us about the case." I said, "No, thanks, Woody. It's really not that big a deal to me. And it's a long drive, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to get on my car and I'm going to drive 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours to get to Martha's Vineyard. Where the fuck am I going to stay? I mean, and you're not even offering to pay me. I mean, he just thinks, well, it's Woody and Ted have called you up, so of course you're going to get on your motor scooter and you're going to come right over." I just hate him. I just hate the guy. And I realized probably my own worst enemy that I, again, could have ingratiated myself with this superstar. But, pride, and I didn't do it. And I was just too proud to suck up to him. And so I didn't do it. And then a couple of days later, I get a call from Taylor. And he says, I'm in West Springfield and I got a subpoena in my hand. And the trial's beginning in Denver. And unless you immediately tell me everything you know about the case that you haven't told me and Danny, I'm with a U.S. Marshal. And we're going to send a, we're going to come over and we're going to subpoena you as a hostile witness
Oh my gosh.
to appear in this trial. And I said to him, Bill, honest to God, I've never been subpoenaed before in my life, and it would be a thrill to see how that experience unfolds. Of all the things, a lot of things have happened to me in my life. If you've read Pisces Moon, you get it. A sampling, plus all the stuff that's just gone down in Texas, and a million things I haven't even told you about. And I said, yeah, I've never, come on over, deliver the subpoena, and of course it was a bluff, and there is none, and I really did want to get subpoenaed. I swear to you, it would have been interesting to have to go to this trial and explain all this stuff at the trial, but it was just another fantasy, and he was trying to scare me and stuff. And really, the only thing that scares me at that point is the mafia, and that if I actually can implicate members of the mafia in a murder, that I'm dead. And it doesn't matter what you find out about the DEA or the FBI or the CIA, they're not going to kill you, but the mafia will. So, there's a point where in any investigation where the survival instinct kinks in, and I had reached that point. And so, it all ended there. And anyway, that's the quick summary of what happened. And
What ended up happening at the retrial?
oh, yeah.
Because I'm assuming it didn't go very well.
So they actually have a trial, and Charlie gets out of the Supermax prison, which I think is in Colorado, and he goes and he testifies, and what he says, my father is the most articulate, well-read person I have ever read, and I don't know whether or not he's guilty or not of the Wood murders, but I really admire the guy. And, like it's like watching the King of Hearts, where the crazy people take over the asylum, and he has all these fantasies about his father, who's a stone cold killing son of a bitch, and it's like believing every word this guy's telling him, and his own father is manipulating him and using him and twisting his mind and everything he thinks to be true, like Charlie confessed to killing Kennedy, for God's sake. And Robert Kennedy Jr. believes him. And it's like 20 million people who want to vote for Jr. And they're right up there with the crowd that thinks that Trump's fighting the deep state. And this is a situation that we're working within in this country. And then they're using as a defense that the lawyers who represented Charlie didn't do a good job. They're not using the material evidence that I gave them. They're, for some reason, they're using that Tom Sharp, who was Charlie's attorney, didn't do it. They're saying he got inferior legal representation. Anyway, the case never gets decided, because the next day, the media finds Woody shooting hoops with the judge on a public course in Denver. And immediately the judge has to recuse himself. And Charlie goes back to Supermax prison, and the case is dead forever, because nobody else is gonna retry a case for Charlie Harrelson without actually having material evidence. So Woody's own fantasy world keeps, by feeling the need to play hoops with a judge who's also on the train to Hogwarts and thinks it would be really really cool to shoot hoops with Woody Harrelson. And the media, meanwhile, is sneaking around, following him with cameras. And they're so fucking stupid that they actually do it. And now Charlie goes back to prison where really he's happiest in life and dies there, and there's still people that believe a word that he said, all of which is utter nonsense, including Woody, who can't decide whether he's actually the roles he's playing in his movies, whether he's a good guy or a murderer, at one point, whether he's a stupid dumb fuck or whether he's actually, like he says of his father, a very articulate, well-read guy who understands things. And he's, then I watched him in True Detectives, and which is like, pretty funny. Has no basis in reality at all, though you gotta admit he's a pretty good actor. And at one point, Matthew McConaughey, who's also on the train to Hogwarts, says to him, nothing but sentient meat. And Woody, a couple of seconds later, looks over at Matthew McConaughey and he says, "What do you mean we're scented meat?" I mean, and that pretty much sums up what's going on. Believe me, Matthew McConaughey is not an intellectual, and neither is Woody. And they really have no idea what's going on. They're just these twisted Hollywood actors who have their girl call you up and think that because they got 20 million fans like RFK Jr. or Donald Trump, that they're actually important. And they're no different than you and me, except they're a little more deluded. Anyway, I was going to say something, but that might have been what I was getting to anyway. It is that, the whole idea is to focus on the facts and to really try and find them. But to do that, they're very dangerous. And you really have to go through the sorts of things that I did and that Alan Block did. And when you start bumping up against organized crime, it really is a dangerous world. And anyway, I wrote all about it in my books, although living it is a completely different experience. And if I can think of something else I want to say, I'll tell you. And maybe you could just write something up and plug it in. But I think that's it for today. All
Excellent. Thank you so much for
right.
sharing these stories with us.
Okay, well, I hope somewhere along the line it benefits somebody. Okay.
Definitely. I know we'll all en we enjoyed hearing it, so thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
I've been told as you sow, so shall you reap. And the sins that you do, two by two, you pay for one by one. In my younger years, I was wild and free. Now those days are past and gone. But Lord, ain't the reaping ever done. Ain't the reaping ever done. Ain't the debt ever paid. I work my fingers to the bone. Can't even pay the interest on the loan. Oh Lord, ain't the reaping ever done. Been heartache for heartache, sin for sin. I'd be happy to break even, don't expect to ever win. But my family has gone without, through no fault of their own. Now they're paying too, ain't the reaping ever done. Ain't the reaping ever done, ain't the debt ever paid, there ain't sure is a bumper crop. Oh Lord, ain't the reaping ever done? Ain't the reaping ever done? Ain't the debt ever paid? I'm a giving everything I have. I didn't know I'd run up such a tab. Done. Oh Lord, ain't the reaping ever done?